Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Web Sleuths Radio. More taste, less filling, and always informative. Web Sleuths Radio is brought to you by a wonderful organization called DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. This is a nonprofit organization where their mission is to educate the public on child abuse symptoms, interventions, and preventions. Please, please, please visit them at DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. Tonight, we welcome forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht. He'll be joining us a little bit later on in the show. Also, true crime author Donna Kaufman. And Dr. Wecht and Donna's new true crime book, From Crime Scene to Courtroom, is due out in October. And trust me, you are going to love this book. It has a great section on Casey Anthony. You're going to love that one. And joining us, very popular Web Sleuths member, Cynic. And our topic tonight is the strange case of the death of Rebecca Zahow. And we'll be talking about that in just a minute. But first, it's time for our segment, What the Heck Has Casey Anthony Done Now? The judge orders Casey to pay $100,000 to cover the cost for searching for her daughter when she knew where Kaylee was the whole time. Good for the judge. And the results of our Web Sleuths poll, does former Anthony prosecutor Jeff Ashton have more of a right to write a book than Cindy and George Anthony? 76.46% said yes, Ashton does have more of a right to write a book. 19.93% said no, and 3.61% were not sure. This week's poll that will be put up right after the show is, how did Rebecca die? Murder? Suicide? Don't know. Let's get right to it, okay? I want to say that I love this woman. She's just amazing. True crime author Donna Kaufman has been on Rebecca's case since day one. And Donna, I'm not really sure of the overview of the case. Can you give us just a quick rundown, kind of a capsule story, if you will, of this case and what it's all about?
Yes, happily. Jonah Shacknai is the person who lives in the home on Coronado Beach. It's an oceanfront historic property called the Spreckles Mansion, 27 rooms in the main house and two guest homes attached to the property. And it is a place where he would spend his summer with his girlfriend, Rebecca Zahow, and his three children, two from a first marriage, one from a second marriage. And they would come out and spend time with Pops and the girlfriend. So this time on July 11th, only the six-year-old from the second marriage, a little boy named Max Field, they called him Maxie, was at the home, and he had been, he was a rambunctious six-year-old, and he somehow fell over the banister of the second story and landed on the floor, and Rebecca heard the crash. She was in another room, and she came out and tried to give him CPR, and someone called 911. Her sister was there. They called 911. And there was no response from the boy. Actually, the last thing he did was said the name of his dog, which is so sad.
Oh, God.
And after that, he had brain death, and his condition did not improve, as it usually doesn't with brain death. And but somehow, as families do, they were hopeful that something was going to happen, and they had the best medical minds looking into this. So this was on the 11th of July. Rebecca had a career. They all sort of lived in Arizona when they weren't summering in Coronado, and that's where Jonah had his company headquarters, and his company was the maker of some wonderful products that were competition to Botox and Restylane. They were for cosmetica, fillers, and that kind of thing. Huge money in that. Last year, he made $123 million on top of $700 million. So there was really big money on that. Rebecca had her own career. She worked for an optical outlet. And recently, they had been together for 2 years, and in the last few months, she decided their relationship was getting more serious. She quit her job to be the wife figure, girlfriend figure, someone pretty on his arm to go to events and to kind of watch the kids when Jonah wasn't around. So she was the only adult known to be in the house when the boy had his accident, and her 13-year-old sister was also there. So we don't know, and we've never heard, if there's a staff, a 27-room mansion and two
outer homes. That's what I was
going
to ask. She has
no
to watch
staff.
The kids.
I mean, I know people living in their car and they have a staff. I've always wondered, is there a bodyguard here for a guy who's so rich? Is there? Are there assistants? Are there cooks?
Why wasn't there a nanny? I mean,
that's
I don't. That's very surprising to me. That's an interesting point. Okay, so unfortunately,
anyway,
the little boy dies.
Accidents, and there seems to be no mistaking that this was an accident. But yet they were hopeful. Rebecca was under orders not to go to the hospital because the boy's mother, who also lived in Coronado and Phoenix, was there, and she didn't want Rebecca around. Now, whether they blamed Rebecca for this horrible thing that happened to the boy, we don't know. Her family has said she didn't blame herself, and she wasn't. She was suffering from the boy's accident, but she wasn't looking at herself as the reason that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows? So there are phone calls that were released, and she was talking the next day, which would be the 12th of July. His brother came in from out of town, and she picked him up at the airport, and then she and Jonah went to the hospital, and he went in and visited with Jonah at the hospital and saw the kid. And then Jonah, the brother, whose name is Adam, and Rebecca all went out to dinner, and this around 8 o'clock, they split up. Jonah went back to the hospital, and Adam, the brother, and the Rebecca went back to the house. The sister had gone home by that time.
Mm-hmm.
So Rebecca goes to the main house. Adam goes to the guest house. And that's the last time he says he saw her. There were phone calls now and text messages between Rebecca and her sisters and other people in that evening from 8 until whenever, for the next couple hours. She is pretty active on the phone. At 12:50, we are told there was a checking of her answering machine, her voicemail,
mm-hmm.
and it was a call. She was on. She listened to one or more calls for about 2 minutes, and shortly after that is when we believe she died. And what was in that call? Well, cops won't return the cell phone to Rebecca's family. They won't give her that. I don't know why they won't.
If they've ruled it a suicide,
Rebecca,
why wouldn't they give it back?
Well, why not, indeed? Are they still investigating?
Right.
We hope.
But
seems to me that whoever made that phone call, which was rumored at first to be Jonah, it was somebody saying, we just found out that Maxie is not going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have been a really difficult phone call for whomever made it and for whoever heard that. But it seemed to set into motion what happened next to Rebecca. What we know for sure is that the brother Adam got up around 6:30 in the morning, went outside and saw Rebecca hanging from a rope. Her feet were two off the second balcony. Her feet were 2 feet from the ground, and he pulled over a table and cut her down, and he tried to give her CPR, but it was useless because she was already dead, and then he called 911. And so that's the basic fact. Now, what happened? Was it suicide? Was it homicide? Or was it something else?
Go ahead.
After an exhaustive investigation, so say the Coronado police and the San Diego authorities and the coroner's office, they determined that Maxie's death was pure accident and that Rebecca's was a suicide. And when you have a suicide like that, you have to think, well, was it her trying to make it look like a homicide?
Mm-hmm.
It's reported that she was naked. Her hands were bound behind her back with a piece of red rope, the kind that you tow boats with. And the same kind of rope was around her ankles, and the same kind of rope was around her neck. And that was what was suspending her from the balcony. On the other end of the balcony, there was a bedroom there, and that rope was tied in a rather interesting knot to the bed leg. So that's why she didn't collapse to the ground when she hung herself. So it was a pretty sturdy, because even though she was only 100 pounds, 5 feet 3 inches, over 2 hours, that's a lot of dead weight. So
mm-hmm.
it held her up. And around her shins, there were pieces of sticky gray substance that could be from duct tape. But we're not told if there was any duct tape in the house. Was there any duct tape on the... There were two knives around that were apparently used to cut the ropes. Did they show any detritus of gray substance that could be from duct tape? Well, if they did, we don't know about it. And there were injuries that Dr. Wecht looked at, the autopsy, and said, wait a minute, there are very defined injuries here that don't make sense with the theory that they're telling us. The police did a recreation of how she could have they say that she tied her feet first, she put the loop over her neck, and then she tied one wrist, created knots, and then put both hands behind her back and put the wrist into the final knot, and that's what fixed her hands behind her back. So they got somebody of similar size and shape to do that wrist reaction, and they filmed it, and they showed that to us when they did their press conference.
Yeah, and that is available online, by the way.
I'm sorry?
That is available online at the San Diego Sheriff's Department. It's a very interesting demonstration. So
yes.
You just go, I think it's...
And so is the autopsy, and so is the investigation stuff. And all in the autopsy thing, they admit this looked like a hinky case. It looked suspicious, and it caught our attention. And so that's good, but mm-hmm. then they'd close it down and say, okay, no more questions. That's it. Here's our report. And they don't address many things. Now, they could be absolutely right that it was a suicide, but given what they have provided so far, there are still unanswered questions. And Ann Bremner, who is the Seattle attorney of great renown and a very smart cookie, was somebody who's been on TV many, many, many times.
Oh, yes, I know Ann very well.
Yeah, and Rebecca's family hired her to look into this whole case, and she has been asking for things like the return of the cell phone, like the photos of the painted message which on the door into
That's
the room
what I want to talk about. What is
the
message that they're talking about that's so bizarre?
It's a very bizarre message, and the family doesn't understand it. It says it's not how she would talk, and it's not really a goodbye or up yours message. It's painted in black paint with a paintbrush, and it says, she saved him, can he save her? It's also been reported in the autopsy report, it says, can you save her? So
mm-hmm.
Rebecca's brother, who was told, it's can he save her? I think that's very interesting. Now, is that something that she painted there herself to say, what happened 2 years ago? Did she ever save him? Was or somebody else?
Right.
There somebody else here? I mean, did he have substance abuse and she brought him back from that? And that was something that she was helpful for. But in her time of need, it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who knows? We just don't know what that means. Maybe it refers to the little boy. Maybe she didn't write it, but maybe somebody else wanted to cast some suspicious spin on this. We just don't know. They have not released that picture. The family who has seen it said that's not her handwriting. But when you do handwriting, it doesn't necessarily match how you would use a paint brush and paint. She was an artist, and I suggest that they look at whether she signed her paintings and see there if any of the letters match to this message. But that's another thing that was not fully explained. One of the things that happens when you investigate deaths, and Dr. Weck can tell you this too, is families don't want to think that their loved one committed suicide.
Exactly.
And so they go to the authorities and they say, you know, reopen this case, and the authorities go, well, bring us a lawyer. If you want to talk turkey, you need to do it through somebody else, because no one wants to deal with an emotional family member who won't listen to reason, period. Mm-hmm. So that's what they did. They got Ann Bremner, and Ann Bremner got Dr. Wecht, and has put together a pretty awesome team, and now they're still not giving information.
And that in itself is what is very troubling to me about this. I don't know why they're not open with it. They don't need to be open with us. Yeah, we're nosy. We want to know. And, yeah, because it's me, I think I have a right to know, gosh darn it, because I want to. But I really don't. As long as they just give it to the family, what's the problem? Is there an ego issue here? Just for God's sakes, let the family know what's going on. And then Ann Bremner can come out and say, we've got it all. We're looking it over. Everybody calm down. Chill out. We'll let you know. But they're not doing that, and that's
or
just
they
nuts.
Have sufficiently told us stuff that was not in the report, and now we get what they're talking about. Now we see it. I worked a hanging in the L.A. area a few years ago, and the authorities, in order to point the finger at somebody they suspected was the person who pushed the person off the balcony, did a recreation with a dummy of the same size and shape and weight, and did it, from every possible angle to see if the wounds could be replicated and if the theory that the guy was saying matched.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up putting him in jail. So did the authorities do that kind of a test? Even on computer, as we'll get to Cynic's test, which was fabulous.
It's amazing.
Did they do that?
Mm-hmm.
So recreation should happen. Also, the phone message is now, Anne is told, that on the phone call that came through to that was, the kid's dead, whatever happened next, that has been deleted. Well, that's tampering with evidence, if that's factual. And why is that happening? I mean, instead of looking at this woman as the person we have, as suspicious, we have to look at everybody in this case and say, why was this done? It really matters that this guy was a major player in the city, and you.
I was just going to say that.
You can point to the fact that the San Diego Union-Tribune is barely covering this case. And you have to really dig. They did some early stuff, but they're not talking about the controversy on this case at all. And he has, of course, as he has every right to get a publicity company out there throwing, bombs and, threats to Ann Bremner to stop talking about the case, which to her great...
How can he control that? He wasn't even married to her. How can he control
exactly.
it? That right there is a window, perhaps, into his ego, thinking that he can control what this family does with the information. They have a right to know. Let's get to Cynic. Cynic is one of our most we love Cynic. He's on Web Sleuths, and I'm so grateful because the man is a genius. And Cynic in the forum, in the Rebecca Zahal forum. And by the way, that is in the Hot Cases forum on WebSleuths.com. Cynic, first of all, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tricia.
Cynic, I know he hates it when I do this, but he's an absolute genius, and he has done an animation recreation, and I want you to explain it, and then explain what we were talking about off the air, about the length between legal hanging, what happens at a legal hanging, and what happened with Rebecca's case. Let's talk about the animation first.
Okay, well, since the police chose not to recreate the case, as a matter of fact, they mentioned that they were specifically not going to do that at any time. They were going to rely on the forensics, I believe, was their statement. So I thought, well, I'm going to look at what they say happened and, you know, see if that might match up with some of the injuries that are noted in the autopsy. So the police theory of the case is that because of some footprint and toe print impressions on the balcony, that Rebecca, while her feet were bound, took basically one hop onto the balcony, then hopped about 17 inches forward, making one toe impression. And from that point, we are expected to believe that she leaned over and fell headfirst approximately 9 feet and 2 inches, at which point she stopped. So I wanted to see how that would, you know, essentially look. I especially wanted to see where her head would line up as she leaned over the railing, which we are told is about 3 feet. I would also like to know exactly how high it was, but I assumed for the purpose of that recreation that it was 36 inches. So in that recreation, Rebecca's face, I think, would have actually rotated forward with some force, basically smashing her face into a very hard steel railing. Then she would proceed to drop because of gravity. Her face would drop over about a foot and a half of railing, and her torso would drop, 2 feet or more through, again, very hard, unforgiving steel. And yet in the autopsy report, it says under the heading torso, injuries, none. Again, face. Where's the injury to her nose, to other portions of her face? All we see anywhere on the head are 3 very small abrasions on the forehead. That's the extent of it. And I find that just incredible.
Tell me about legal hanging and then compare it to Rebecca and the autopsy report.
Well, again, as I said, we're told that she dropped 9 feet 2 inches. When you look up judicial hanging or, you know, somebody's executed legally, there are certain formulas that they try to abide by to ensure that a person's spine is severed and that they die as quickly as possible. You're not looking to have the person suffer, obviously. So in some of these tables, and there is, you know, I will concede that there is some variation. However, one table here, and I'm just looking at it as we speak, says weight of prisoner, 105 pounds and under. The drop in feet that's recommended is 8 feet. And, of course, as I just said, Rebecca dropped 9 feet 2 inches. Why wasn't her spine broken? Why weren't there serious spinal injuries? That's what I want to know.
And that, to me, is very, very compelling. Now, the guest that I have on today, I have Donna Kaufman, true crime author, and Dr. Cyril Weck will be joining us in just a little bit, and our very own Cynic. I say that like I own you, Cynic, and basically I do, let's just admit it. Our very own Cynic from Web Sleuths. We're talking about the Rebecca, and how do you say her last name? I keep saying it wrong. Is it Zahow? Zahow. Rebecca Zahow case. Was it murder? Was it suicide? Very powerful boyfriend in San Diego. The police, there have been some accusations that they didn't investigate it well. They're not giving Rebecca's family the information that they want. Her very powerful boyfriend, whose house the either suicide or murder occurred, is saying kind of threatening things to the family to knock it off, or to the lawyer that they've hired, which to me speaks volumes. Donna, let's go back to you. Let's talk a little bit. We're gonna touch with this on with Dr. Weck. You said that a lot of times families don't want to believe their loved ones committed suicide.
Right.
Is there anything? First of all, from what I understand, this is just very uncommon for Asian women to be naked, and that's you know, very humiliating for them to be naked and to commit suicide. So
well,
culturally,
I'm glad you mentioned that because I'm not sure she was naked. And
oh, really?
I'll tell you why. There was a long sleeve T-shirt that was over her shoulders, not over her head, and it was laying around, was wrapped three times around her neck and pushed into her mouth. And we're all thinking, okay, from it's a gag. We're not sure why, but that long sleeve T-shirt, is that something she was in the habit of sleeping in? And therefore, because it wasn't, in other words, it was around her, it was over the rope around her neck. Okay?
How could that be?
So
how
that
could
was
that
the
be?
The last thing that came off her. And remember, she had black paint on her breast, just a kind of just there. It wasn't painted, but it was just little spots of black paint. So the painting happened the last. Then the T-shirt was wrapped the second to last, and anything else that happened was before that. My theory could be, and this is just a possibility, that if she was in the bathroom, her bathroom, maybe that's where the assault, if there was one, happened. And as she was getting into her T-shirt to go to bed for the night.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the fact that she was on her period. She did not have a tampon in.
Now, see, that's,
Was there
very
one
weird.
In the bathroom that she, had opened and was going to put in? Was there one that she had taken out? I mean, you'd think that who would not put a tampon in? So is that where that crime occurred, if there was a crime? And did they even go to that part of the house? Did the cops and the CSI people only do their investigation in the guest house and ignore the main part of the house? Because I think that would be a tremendously huge mistake if they did not also check what was happening in her bathroom. So we need to ask her friends and family, did she sleep in a T-shirt? Did she wear tampons?
Right.
And we do have some questions.
I'd like to just say
is we're at the point now, it's, you know, it's like the authorities there are blowing Ann off and saying, well, we've told you everything, that's it. Well, that isn't it. Here's what has to happen. An attorney needs to write a writ of mandamus, which is compelling law enforcement to disclose.
Mm-hmm.
And if they, if you get a judge to say, yeah, we want you to do those tests off the balcony with a dummy, that judge is going to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you cannot push around a judge. You could try to push around family members, but we're at the point where that has to happen. And these processes, whether it's getting an attorney to write that or to perhaps if we believe that they did a sloppy autopsy to exhume her and do a second autopsy, now we're getting into stuff that costs money. And Snowim Zahau, who is the sister of Rebecca, has a website, which is probably mentioned on Web Sleuths. It's called justiceforrebecca.org. And they're looking for donations. You know, please, if you care about this case, and 87% of people in a recent poll think that she has been murdered, then this is how you can really help, get some answers.
We have a question. We have lots of questions, actually, in the chat room. V. LeGay wants to know how could she measure the rope? How could she know, you know, the rope was, I mean, that's a pretty long rope. You know, you'd have to have some knowledge of length and how high up off the ground you were. I mean, isn't that odd that the rope was just perfect, you know, that she was just 2 feet off the ground? Wouldn't somebody hanging themselves just hang themselves in the house where they would know?
It's a good question. I don't know that we'll ever have an answer to that because the thing that they have said is, and I'm impressed with some of the things that the police have said, which is that there were no other footprints except for one boot print on the balcony that was traced to one of the cops who worked the case. There were only her footprints on the dusty balcony. That's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And they also could find no handprints or DNA of anyone besides her on the rope, and on the bed and on the knives that cut the rope. Well, that's interesting. But then you say, so what about the brother who cut her down? Where's his DNA on that rope?
Mm-hmm.
How, you know? But the answer to that, they say, is, well, we didn't check the whole rope. We just checked the part that was around her neck. So, you know, that's another thing. They could go back and shut us up by doing a better test and telling us, you know, I don't know what to think about the person who would have, a murderer who would have hovered in midair to get her over that balcony. That's pretty impressive. But let me throw out another thing.
Well, can I just jump in?
Yeah.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, you can make that argument about, you know, her hovering, about a murderer hovering in midair, but you'd have to, unfortunately, make that same argument for Rebecca. How did, I mean, if I was committing suicide, again, that issue of the length of the rope, I would like to know, or I would go out onto the balcony, you know, throw the rope down, have some idea where it's going to be, you know, where it's going to hang at the end of its travel, and then tie it, then, you know, then make the appropriate knots and adjustments to do it. So if Rebecca didn't go out onto the balcony prior to her doing this, then how did she know the length of the rope as well? That whole hover question works both ways, I'm afraid.
Exactly. Okay.
Well,
yes, I have...
You know, the thing that, and that's what basically what the poster said is, how do you know the length of the rope? Well, you know, we're never going to know that because no one's talking about that. Who has?
Right.
Rebecca's not here to talk about that.
Okay.
So,
well, I have to interrupt. I have to interrupt everybody. We have our very special, incredible guest on the air with us here, and I have to remind everybody that last time when I interrupted Dr. Cyril Weck, I almost got murdered. Myself, so we shall not interrupt him ever. Dr. Cyril Weck, famous pathologist, thank you so much for joining us on Web Sleuth Radio today.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you. Sorry to interrupt you folks, but I'm glad to join in.
Oh, well, we really want you. We've been talking with Donna and one of our members from Web Sleuth, Cynic. And Donna, why don't you, since you and Dr. Weck have been working on this together, why don't you ask Dr. Weck the startup question as to what is the problem with the autopsy? Where should we start with the autopsy?
Okay. Thank you. And let me first back up and say who he is for people just landing on Earth for the first time. Dr. Cyril Weck is, I think, the finest forensic pathologist in the world. He has done a combined from 17,000 personal autopsies to 37,000 ones that he consulted on. That's a combined 54,000 autopsies. So there's probably nothing that he hasn't seen many, many times over, and yet this case captured his interest because it's unusual, and he is also a lawyer. He's in court. He's at crime scenes, which is why we named our book what we did, and he just has a very good scientific way of explaining autopsy reports and putting it into words that jurors and laymen and dopes like I can understand, and it's a
okay,
pleasure
so
knowing him.
He is, and I agree with everything you say. Dr. Weck is absolutely amazing. I don't even know where to begin with the autopsy report.
Well,
Donna,
listen, I like to quit right now while I'm ahead. Anything I do or say from here on in is only going to lead to some diminution of that brain.
No, not at all. Donna,
so
what's the most compelling
thing? Dr. Weck looked at Rebecca's autopsy report and saw things that were glaring inconsistencies and or errors or needed more explanation, including that she had blows to her head. And please explain how those blows, where they occurred. They were not topical blows. They were?
Well, there are four subgaleal, subscapular, essentially the same, which means beneath the scalp and above the calvarium, the bony top of the skull. And that had not been commented upon previously, as far as I was aware. I got a call, I think it was 2 weeks ago yesterday, from the San Diego television people. I was driving from New Jersey up to Connecticut, and then they lined me up for an interview later that evening. There were, in the autopsy report that was sent to me, some things that, as I say, hadn't been noticed or commented upon before. Not that I discovered something like Columbus discovering America, but the significance of these things in this particular case, I believe, cannot be ignored. And I am puzzled, frankly, by the fact that a forensic pathologist, and it was a competent, experienced forensic pathologist who did this autopsy, had not commented upon it, at least, well, if he had, then to the sheriff and whoever it was that was dealing with the public and news media chose not to comment upon four separate such subscapular hemorrhages. And these can be caused by the head impacting against something or some instrumentality impacting against the scalp, not so forceful as to produce a laceration or a fracture, but strong enough, forceful enough to produce hemorrhage. Keep in mind,
so you don't see it on the outside. The skin is not broken. She's not bleeding into her hair. But under, when they pull back the face and look at the scalp, you can see four very red marks there, and red means fresh. So she
shouldn't couldn't she have hit her head going down? Couldn't she just hit her head going down?
Well, I don't see. See, the point I wanted to make, just feel your own head as we're talking, your listeners and you guys, and you'll see, of course, that we have contours, we have concavities, and we have convexities. So which that means that in order to get four separate subscapular hemorrhages, you've got to have four separate impacts.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They can't be caused by one particular impact. You ask a question, and I think some people have said, well, gee, could that have happened in the hanging? I don't see how go over the balcony. You've got the rope around your neck. It's a vertical drop. I don't understand how your head is going to impact something four times. I just can't envision this. It doesn't make any sense. It isn't as if
the rope is...
If it were a bungee cord, you know, you'd say, well, really, you know, I'm not being flipped, but the body coming back up and down for a few times before it comes to rest and maybe hitting on the undersurface of the balcony if it protrudes. But this is not a bungee cord. This is a rope that does not bounce back and forth. So that's one very big thing. Then you've got some adhesive marks on the lower calves, which are clearly indications that some kind of adhesive material had been applied there. Well, what in the world would that have been for? She has rope around the lower parts of her calves, above the ankles. Where, if she had been using adhesive tape and decided to switch to rope, where is the adhesive tape? No comment on that. Then you've got the rope around the neck and a T-shirt three times encircling that rope with a portion of it jammed into her mouth. And again, not meaning to be flip, but what in the world would that be for? Is she concerned, gee, if I scream, somehow I'm going to wake somebody up or somebody's going to come
I know
and
what
save
you're saying.
Me? And then the biggest thing, the hands tied behind the back with some very special kind of slip knot or so on. I have enjoyed over the past 2 weeks in talking to news media, and I want to do it again this evening with you, and that is, tell me, are you capable of doing that? For them to have put on a little demonstration and show that somebody knows how to do that. I know that somebody knows how to do that. Harry Houdini did it 70 years ago. Tell me how Ms. Zahal could do it. Tell me, where did she acquire that knowledge, that dexterity, that facility of knots? If someone came to me right now and said, Wecht, here's $1 million, you show me how to put your hands in and out of a slip knot, well, I just blew making $100, $1 million, because I don't know how to do it.
Exactly.
And who in the world does know how to do it? Did she just study, bone up on that, and practice it for a few hours before she then committed suicide? And why would she want to do that? So when you put this all...
A similar knot was tying the rope to the bed leg as well. That was also a very proficient knot. It wasn't just tied in a bow. It was tied to take an extreme amount of weight and not to give and not to fall apart.
And one final comment, and then I'll stop on this business of what bothered me about the whole scenario here, that she was nude. Well, I'm not telling you that a woman never, never commits suicide nude, but I will tell you it is rare. More, I think, less so than infrequent. I think I can, without engaging in hyperbole, say rare. Offhand, I can't think of a woman. I'm sure I have had some in the couple hundred or more women suicides, maybe a few hundred, I don't know how many, but I guess I've had some, but offhand I can't remember any. Women have a sense of propriety, of dignity, of decorum, call it whatever you will, even in this kind of a final act of committing suicide. And they just don't, you know, lie around or shoot themselves nude. So when you put all of these things together, you know, you can explain this and that and so on, but I think I mentioned four or five things, all of which are there, none of which I am conjecturing upon, that I am creating in order to say, well, what if this and what if that? These are things that are there in the autopsy, on the body, around the body, with the overall scene. And the final point I want to make, we'll open up for discussion, is that I am not going so far as to say that this is a homicide. I think that would not be scientifically valid for me to make such an assertion at this point. But I do not hesitate to say that to call this a suicide and declare that the investigation has been consummated and that there is no question at all about this being a suicide, I think there is no question that that is a premature determination. It is a professionally irresponsible thing to do. There is no way in the world that they have addressed all of these issues and others, I'm sure, that maybe you folks have been talking about, including that note, she saved him, can he save her, what does that mean, and so on. I mean, there's a lot of things that have to be investigated here. This was a premature rush to judgment, and that case definitely should be reopened. There's just nothing that is the least bit equivocal about the need for that to be done.
We're talking with forensic pathologist Dr. Sarah Weck, true crime author Donna Kaufman, and we have our wonderful member from Web Sleuth, Cynic. And Cynic, I'll be going to you in just a moment. You have some questions for the good doctor. But Dr. Weck, I don't know if you remember this. About 8 years ago, you and I spoke. You actually were kind enough to help me with a couple of cases. I was helping some families who, again, didn't want to admit that their kids committed suicide. And you very graciously agreed to look at the reports and to draw a conclusion to see if it needed to be opened. And all of the cases, I think it was just two of them, actually, it was you concluded, based on what you saw just then, it was a suicide. And that's very hard for people to take.
And
in fact, you told me some horrific stories of suicides, a ballpoint pen suicide. I know there was a suicide here in Utah where the woman tried to frame her ex-boyfriend. She had it all planned out. She even dug a hole like several feet away from where she shot herself. She shot herself, crawled over to the hole, buried the gun, crawled back, and then wrote in the sand, "He killed me." And they were able to determine that she did that to get even with him. Is there any way that maybe, that just maybe, Rebecca wanted to get even with her boyfriend, with somebody in that household, and did all this weird stuff, you know, taped her legs, took the tape off, wrote a weird note? I know it seems a little illogical, but maybe we're not dealing with any sort of logic here, and that's the problem. What do you say to that?
Well, it is perfectly legitimate and logical for you to raise that question, that is why I say that I'm not prepared to make the statement that it is not a suicide, that there is no way in the world that it could be a suicide. I think that maybe these things can be explained. The point I make, and I restate for emphasis, is that until these questions have been answered reasonably, responsibly, credibly, with utmost objectivity and legitimacy, then the case should not be signed out as a suicide.
Well, and I also
let me just zero in on to reiterate. I ask you not, again, not to be the least bit facetious or dramatic. I just hypothesize that I'm a billionaire, and I want to prove my point. And so I'm saying to you now on your program, I give you my promise with all your listeners as witnesses that I will give you $1 million if you can demonstrate for me and have it videotaped this evening and sent to me how you are able to work this Slipknot or whatever you call it.
Couldn't
with
do
your
it.
Hands tied behind
Couldn't
your back.
Couldn't do it.
No, Naomi, can you do that?
Absolutely
do
not. Absolutely
okay.
not.
Well,
no.
How did she do it?
I don't know. And I think we have to take into consideration here the fact that the boyfriend is so he's being difficult. You know, he doesn't want to help the family. He's even threatening the family. Is that correct?
Yeah, right, really. I didn't know that.
I mean, it kind of like, isn't he, Donna, isn't he kind of saying, hey, you better stop it. You better stop saying these things.
Yes, his publicity, people said that. But one other thing that happened is right when the coroner showed up, who also showed up was Paul Fingst, P-F-I-N-G-S-T, the two-time former DA of San Diego. And he would not say why he was there. And then he told a reporter later that he was repping somebody at the household, but it wasn't Jonah. So what does that mean? He's repping the brother?
What was that verb? He was doing what?
Repping.
Representing.
Representing,
okay.
That's bizarre.
So, of course, there's no crime that's been charged, but he was there to protect somebody's interest.
Right.
And he also wanted to have people he knew observe the autopsy. Let me ask you, Dr. West, if you did a second autopsy, what would that have value? Because if we have to see if the police have so many deficits in their crime investigation and so many unanswered questions and seeming bad procedure done in terms of recreation not performed and evidence that they are not forthcoming with, can we trust the autopsy report? And would you be able to exhume her body and find make your own findings?
Well, I don't want to cast any aspersions upon the pathologist and suggest that he either covered up or was negligent. I have no basis to say that, and I won't state that. However, I do believe that in cases like this, which are highly controversial and which will quite likely result in some kind of adversarial proceeding, that it is wise, it is a good tactical maneuver when it can be accomplished financially, emotionally, psychologically, religiously, and so on, insofar as the family of the decedent is concerned and the attorney representing the decedent family and so on, to have an exhumation or a second autopsy, hopefully before the body has been buried, but after it's been buried, to be exhumed and to be examined by the second forensic pathologist. This gives that pathologist a greater understanding and provides an opportunity to have a hands-on look and to determine things for himself. For example, you see, what I would ideally like to do, not me, I think any forensic pathologist would tell you the same thing if he or she were called in on this case. You go to the scene, see exactly where this took place, get some measurements, look and see, for example, is there some way in which the head could have impacted three, four times in this vertical drop, to look and see what kinds of trees and branches and limbs and thorns were there that could have produced some scratches, abrasions, and even contusions on her legs as she was dangling. By the way, I didn't mention that too. Where did all these come from? These are things that must be kept in mind. And as I say, if all the circumstances permit, then it is certainly good to have that done.
Dr. Weck,
I'm sorry, may I ask this question?
Yeah, please go ahead, Donna. Then I have to go to Cynic, okay?
Okay, the strap muscles and the neck muscles and the spinal cord are buried with the body, or could they be in formalin at the ME's office?
Well, I don't know what the pathologist saved, the cervical vertebral column, the spinal cord. I'm sure that that was not removed. Insofar as the strap muscles are concerned and the soft tissues of the neck. Strap muscles, by the way, folks, are these little muscles. They're called strap muscles because somebody thought that they had that rectangular configuration. And they go from different parts of the jaw down to different structures in the neck and around the thyroid gland and so on. They will be there. I don't think that they would all have been excised. They probably were dissected, but not removed. And the other thing is that that which was removed should be asked for in terms of being made available to another forensic pathologist to examine. There's no reason why that should not occur. And if that opportunity were denied, then a question would be raised in my mind: what in the world are you afraid of? What are you concerned about?
Mm-hmm. There you go. We're talking.
Can I just ask one other question too, and then
sure,
you can talk
sure,
about
yeah, absolutely.
What is the manner of what happens when you are hung? Do you die instantly? We know that there was no break in the spine, no fractures.
No, you don't die instantly unless the cervical vertebral column is broken and the spinal cord is stretched out, attenuated, and damaged. But those don't occur unless you're talking about the traditional executioner's drop through gallows. The typical, or somebody jumping out of a window or something like that, getting the same effect. But the typical kind of hanging, including this kind of a case, you would have an asphyxiation taking place. You would have compression of the jugular veins and carotid arteries in the neck, and you would remain conscious for a few seconds, several seconds, and then you would go on to become unconscious, and then you would die. It depends. In hanging, we don't have usually the kind of damage to the neck structures that we see in manual or ligature strangulation, where we will often see a break of the hyoid bone, the little U-shaped bone underneath the mandible, the opening being directed posteriorly, or fractures of the thyroid cartilage, the Adam's apple. In hanging, we sometimes in hangings, we don't see anything. I mean, internally, if we don't know that there was or the body's brought in with a rope or so on, and we were just given a body, sometimes you would not even know that there was a hanging. You look for the furrow marks and indentations on the skin externally. So the answer is that, but I'm not questioning the cause of death. I have no basis to suggest that she was murdered and then hung up, and I'm not suggesting that for one moment. I, from everything I've read, I'm satisfied that this is an asphyxial death due to hanging. I want to make that clear. That's cause of death. What we're talking about, folks, is manner of death, and you either got natural accident, suicide, homicide, or undetermined. And what I'm saying is, at this point, it should have been listed as undetermined, pending further investigation, and then you would go on to decide if it is a suicide or possibly a homicide.
We are talking tonight with the forensic pathologist, world-famous forensic pathologist, Dr. Cyril Weck, and true crime author Donna Kaufman. And Dr. Weck, we have a member on my discussion board who has put together an animation video, which I would like Donna to send to you, if you could, Donna.
Oh, yes, I'd love to see that. Yes, please.
It is amazing. This man is a genius. We just call him Cynic because he's very cynical about everything. He's joining us tonight, and Cynic has some questions for you. Cynic, Dr. Weck is all yours now.
Dr. Weck, a great pleasure and an honor to meet you.
Mr. Cynic, nice talking with you.
I have six questions, some of them my own, some from others on Web Sleuths here. I hope you can humor me by answering a few of these. Prior to coming on air, we were speaking of judicial or execution-style hangings, which you actually just alluded to a moment ago, which are intended, of course, to sever or severely damage the spinal cord to make the execution quick and humane. And there are formulas designed to calculate the required distance that a prisoner must drop. Again, prior to you coming on air, I just shared with everyone from a website. It's an old drop table drop table of required heights to execute a prisoner.
Uh-huh.
And for it has here, for example, actually doesn't list 100 pounds. The lowest weight is 105, although it does say weight of prisoner 105 pounds and under. It gives the drop in feet and inches as 8 feet. And according to the autopsy reports, we're looking at a 9-foot, 2-inch drop. Should there not have been some serious spinal injuries, perhaps not a severed spinal cord, but shouldn't there have been serious spinal injuries?
Well, if in fact, then she literally leaped, jumped from the balcony, and it went down 9 feet, yes, that would be a considerable distance. And I would tend to agree with you that I would expect there to be some dislocation, some subluxation of the cervical vertebral column, a couple of the cervical vertebrae, and some damage to the spinal cord, which courses through the vertebral foramen, the spinal canal.
Thank you. Thank you. That means a lot. I've got a few more. The fracture of the cricoid, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, that's correct.
The ligature furrow, as noted in the autopsy report, indicates that the placement of the ligature was above or superior to the larynx. There's a fracture of the cricoid, which, of course, I don't need to explain to you, is of course, below the larynx. What would be the mechanism for such a fracture? Would that not be suspicious to you?
No. The cricoid cartilage, as you say correctly, is just beneath the thyroid cartilage. It is actually the first circular cartilaginous ring of the trachea. You know, the trachea has in the front the cartilaginous rings and so on. And that is the first one of those. You can have a fracture of the cricoid cartilage without having a fracture of the thyroid cartilage. It'll vary. So, no, that in and of itself doesn't raise any suspicions for me or answer any questions, you know, in terms of what may have happened.
What would be the mechanism of that fracture, though? Because the rope, the furrow line is, as I say, it was noted as being above the larynx. So if the ligature is not crushing it, would it just be a traction-style injury that or traction forces that would have caused the fracture? I'm just looking for the mechanism of the fracture.
Yes, well, it could be, yes. It could be traction, or it could be that with this that the rope may have moved somewhat upward as the body dropped down vertically. You see what I mean? That maybe I don't know how tight the rope was affixed. Sometimes the rope is so tight that it doesn't move. Sometimes, however, the rope is not that tight. You see, if somebody's going to commit suicide, they're not going to, and they're going to jump too. They got to maintain some consciousness. If they make the rope so tight that they can't breathe, they could lose consciousness before they finalize the act. So the rope is, you know, not usually that totally tight, and the weight of the body, albeit relatively small, 100 pounds in this case, could have been enough to cause the rope to move a little bit upward and to be in that position above the cricoid cartilage when the body was examined.
Does
would
gravity
there not have been
come into play here, because she was there for at least 2 hours before she was cut down?
That too, Donna, that's a good point too. The body has definitely become more and more lax, and there is a continuing dropping down vertically, so to speak, nothing dramatic, but the body would not remain, I think, in a totally fixed position. Again, now this depends on the tensile strength of the rope and whether it would continue to be attenuated a little bit as the body remained dangling.
We're on number three. Go ahead, Cynic.
Well, actually, I'd still like one follow-up question on that one. Would there not have been either a secondary furrow line or abrasions to indicate that the rope had slipped, if that was true?
Again, if depending upon the nature of the rope, the kinds of fibers or the kind of fiber that makes up the rope and so on, that's a very good question. I can't answer that because I don't know exactly what kind of rope. I don't know how tightly it was tied and so on. But, yes, if you have a rope and the body remains hanging and so on, then we do expect some increasing width of the circular furrowing to develop.
Okay.
It's not a rope, if I'm not mistaken, and there was a tag on it that said not to be used for more than 300 pounds. So, just throw that out.
Okay, go ahead, Cynic. We have Dr. Cyril Weck and Donna Kaufman and Cynic talking about the Rebecca Zahow case. Go ahead.
Hey, Dr. Weck. Also, prior to coming on air, we discussed a little animation that I developed to try to illustrate the police side of the case. I was looking specifically to try to address where her injuries may have been, if we are to believe the police side of things. And as you probably know, although I'll just reiterate it for the listeners here, the police theory of the case is that while her feet were bound, she took a very short hop and then a subsequent hop of about 17 inches, which would put her about 6 inches away from the balcony railing. And she at that point left a toe imprint, which to the police indicate that she then leaned forward from about 6 inches away, face down, and then proceeded to drop head first. Given, if that's true, my calculations given her height of 5 feet, 3.5 inches, and although we're not specifically told what the height of the railing is, the police just mentioned it was about 36 inches. So I just assumed that it was 36 inches, and given her height of 5 feet, 3.5 inches, the distance she was away from the railing, leaning forward, it means that her face would have probably been making contact with that railing she would have been about 2 feet over the railing. Her face would have had to travel through nearly a foot and a half of hard steel, and her torso would have, the front of her torso would have then followed as she dropped forward. The autopsy report has just one line with respect to marks on her torso, and that's none. Also, there's a complete absence of any marks on her face, especially you would think, would not the nose have been fractured or severely abraded? Because, I mean, that's what sticks out the most, let's face it. All that's noted in the autopsy are three fine abrasions, more or less in the center of her forehead, plus another very small abrasion on the right side of her head, just above the hairline. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, yes. I that's a marvelous analysis that you have done.
He's great. He's a genius. I'm telling you.
No, really. Truly. And that's the kind of thing that I was referring to before that I would like to see for myself to be there. You've just given me some dimensions, some measurements that I wasn't aware of. And I've been wondering, without knowing the exact measurements, how did she do this? Her feet are bound, and she's bouncing around. And then I didn't know 36-inch railing. What do you call it? Is it a balustrade? Is that so? And I assume it's a fancy mansion, and they probably call it something up in a railing. But anyway, I mean, how does she get up there and over and so on? This is an excellent, excellent observation, and I don't have an answer for you. I'd like to hear an answer, and I'd like to see this played out.
So would I, and that's why so many people on Web Sleuths are clamoring for the police to do a recreation. But let's see there. Let's see how this is possible. But
yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
I've got a couple more points. Back abrasions. As I just mentioned, there's no marks on her torso yet. On the back, there's extensive abrasions to the back of Rebecca, and the only explanation that that law enforcement offers is it was a result of contact with foliage below. Again, perhaps some, but if you look at where she went over that railing, it's she would just catch the periphery of of the foliage below. And again, it might account for some of the markings, but the extensive markings that are noted in the autopsy report, again, I just find that just tremendously difficult.
Well, that's right. And you see, I commented on that some minutes ago when I talked about wanting to see that place and the foliage and the bushes and branches and thorns and
exactly.
Whatever they're called. Exactly. Where are they located? How did she get all of these abrasions and even some small contusions, the back and the legs and so on? I mean, and the answer that you get from them is that well, she bumped into this and she bumped into that, and the body brushed against the bushes and so on and so forth. So that's their convenient, facile answer, and it just doesn't make sense. I mean, again, these are excellent points that you make.
Yeah, it's frustrating because it seems like the police answers are, let's just make this go away, so let's just throw something out there and hope that people buy it. But anyway, moving on, I've got a couple questions regarding to petechiae. This was, as I mentioned, a long drop hanging, 9 feet 2 inches. There was a rope expert that was on another talk show, which estimated the force involved, the forces involved at the point where Rebecca ran out of rope to be at approximately 600 pounds. Wouldn't this mean that both the arterial and venous blood flow should have been simultaneously and instantly interrupted? Yet the face of Rebecca shows extensive petechiae. Why would that be? Wouldn't this suggest, possibly a prior episode of manual strangulation as opposed to what happened here?
Yeah, well, as far as the force is concerned, sufficient to constrict the carotid arteries, we usually talk about 11 to 12 pounds, and about 4 pounds for the jugular vein, and so on. Insofar as petechiae are concerned, it's a very, very fascinating phenomenon that we see it in so many asphyxial deaths, and we don't see it in other asphyxial deaths where we would expect to see it. It's something that is inexplicable. Petechiae, the presence of or the absence of, the presence of petechiae is not pathognomonic, a fancy word which simply means exclusive for that particular phenomenon and not found in any other situation. So you can get petechiae from other situations besides asphyxiation. And to turn the coin over, the absence of petechiae does not constitute proof that it was not an asphyxial death. That's the only thing I can say. So, again, it's something that has to be further examined and thought through. But you've got to be careful in saying that because no petechiae were described by the pathologist, that means that this was not an asphyxial death.
Yeah, I guess, again, just given given the forces involved, the length of the drop, I think regardless of the type of ligature involved, there should have been more than enough force involved to tighten that noose to the point where it would have constricted, in my opinion, at least the arterial blood flow. So that's why I was kind of stunned to see the tremendous amount of petechiae that was described in the autopsy report. So that just struck me as odd. Go ahead.
I was going to say, is there a final question?
One
more question. All righty, cool.
Liver mortis. They said that I understand that liver mortis would have definitely appeared on the posterior of Rebecca because she was left laying in the courtyard for an extensive period of time, during which time the liver mortis would have become fixed. However, there's one strange point that I have a tough time explaining. They said that there was red liver mortis on the upper chest. The only explanation I have for this is that she was laying in the courtyard, and when she was laying in the courtyard, she apparently, at least from the shots, had her hands still behind her back, which would have probably tilted her torso back a little bit. Could that be why there would have been liver mortis on the upper chest?
Well, liver mortis, for some of the listeners, is the gravitational settling of blood post-mortem, and it can begin to form an hour and a half, 2 hours after death, doesn't become fixed if the body is moved, and then after about 8 hours or so, it becomes fixed so that even if you move the body and get a second pattern, that first pattern remains, and that's very important for forensic pathologists and homicide detectives to keep in mind when they're wondering whether or not a body has been moved after death. Reddish purple suffusion that you describe, liver mortis, when someone is asphyxiated, then there is a congestive phenomenon. And remember, it will occur in the upper chest area. In other words, the major vein into which all the smaller veins empty, this superior vena cava emptying into the first chamber of the heart. Down in your chest, not far down, but it's in your chest. And therefore, in asphyxial deaths, we can see the suffusion of the face, neck, upper chest and shoulder regions, as well as the more typical kind of liver mortis that you see in the back, in the dependent portions, if the person's lying supine, or in the front, if the person is lying prone.
Wow, I think I need to go back to school to understand a lot of this. Oh, this is absolutely amazing. Donna Kaufman, I'm sorry, yes,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wondered, there's more damage to her neck, interior neck structure on the left side than there is to the right. Would that help you determine how she fell over the, whether she went head first?
Well, yes, to some extent, Donna. I mean, in hangings even sometimes in strangulations, depending upon how the force is applied, you can have more force on one side than the other. It's not necessarily, in fact, quite often, it is not a uniformly concentric distribution of force that encircles the neck, and so it is not at all uncommon for us to see more damage on one side or essentially no damage on one side and damage limited to the other side. That can happen in different kinds of asphyxiation. I mean, either a hanging or a ligature or a manual strangulation.
Go ahead, Sinek. Go ahead.
Sorry. I just have a quick point. Would that not be the case, given that the knot of the noose was approximately around the right ear of Rebecca Zahal, so that would tilt and concentrate the injuries on the other side?
Yes, you're quite right. That's exactly why where the noose is applied, and whether then there is more force, let's say, on the other side with some relative space between the knot and the rope on the one side, whereas on the other side there not being a knot, then the rope is uniformly applied and completely in proximity to the skin. Yes, that explains why you can get this asymmetry.
I'd like to just switch gears a little bit, and Dr. Wecht, if you could put on your lawyer cap for a moment. Now, have you been hired by Rebecca's family? Is that correct? Have they asked you?
Yes. As I told you, I'll give you the exact temporal scenario. I was driving with my wife from a close friend's bar mitzvah in New Jersey. And as we were on Route 95, I get this call from San Diego, I think is it television station number 8, I don't know, and he says, can he email something? So fortunately my wife has some facility with that stuff, and she had her iPad, so they emailed me the autopsy report, and I got to Milford, Connecticut, and they had arranged a time, and they had me on, and I spoke. And then I think... And well, that was a Saturday. The next day was Sunday. My recollection is it was Monday, Labor Day, that I got a call. Was it a call, Sigrid, or an email from Ms. Bremner, the attorney, Attorney Bremner? I think it was an email, I believe. It was an email, not a phone call. And she emailed me, and at that point asked me and told me that I can consider... if I wanted to, and of course I said yes, to be a consultant to her. So that's how it evolved. But all my comments, I want to make this clear, including everything I've said here tonight, just about everything, these were made publicly before. I don't anybody think that, well, I
I understand.
And consulted. No, nothing. There wouldn't be anything wrong with that. But
right.
I'm just saying that I had made these comments
before you were hired. Sure.
Well, before, and I've never met Ms. Bremner, and I'd had the pleasure of working with her on any case. So that's how it happened.
Legally, Dr. Wecht, can the family demand an exhumation, and then can you then perform an autopsy?
Yes.
Do they? Okay.
Once the body has been released by the medical examiner, the coroner, and there is no pending homicide investigation, you see, they can't have it both ways. They can say, oh, no, we object, or so on. Hey, you said it's a suicide. That body now, the vested property rights, so to speak, reside with the next of kin. And they could have had her cremated. They could have had her buried here. They could have kept her in a freezer and whatever. So it is up to them to determine if they want an exhumation autopsy, and the authorities have no legal standing of any kind. I will repeat that unequivocally. They are out of it. Now, if they reopen it and say, hey, this is a homicide investigation, and so on and so forth, and then, even then, I would say they'd have a hard time in preventing the family from having a second autopsy. But as things now stand, they have no legal right whatsoever to deny the families access to the body for performances of an exhumation autopsy. That would be granted by a court. It's entirely up to me. I do maybe at least a half a dozen exhumations a year, probably done maybe more than any other forensic pathologist. I don't know. But families will have it done for one reason or another.
Do you think that will happen in this case?
I honestly don't know. And I'm not being coy. I would tell you if I'm not permitted to answer, I can honestly tell you that I do not know, because that has not been discussed between me and Ms. Bremner. Whether she has discussed it with anybody else or with the family, I do not know.
Okay. Donna, let's go to you. Donna Kaufman, true crime author. We're talking with Dr. Forensic pathologist, wonderful man, and Dr. Cyril Wecht. And Dr. Wecht, you can't see this, but we have a chat room going where people are typing, and everybody just wants me to tell you that they love you and thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
If you get
a note from Sophia Loren, pass it on. Okay?
I will. Donna Kaufman, true crime author. What do you have to say to Dr. Wecht? I've kept you guys on longer than anticipated, so I appreciate you staying with me. But we're going to have to kind of wrap it up here. Donna Kaufman,
okay.
What do you have to say?
Well, there's homicide, there's suicide, and there is wrongful death. And I don't think we should take wrongful death out of the mix here. And I'm not saying Jonah. It could be somebody acting on Jonah's behalf. It could be Jonah. It could be somebody else. Who knows who? It doesn't matter who. But there is such a thing as goading someone into committing suicide. There have been cases that have been tried and attained convictions on that. And also, the death of a child does tend to some people who are type A and wealthy and abusive anyway, it could unhinge somebody. And I'll remind you, in 1980, John Gotti's 12-year-old son was run over accidentally by a neighbor. The kid was on a little putt-putt and went in front of a neighbor's car, and the kid died. And it was an accident. And the neighbor had all sorts of things happen to him, beat up and intimidated, until finally he disappeared. And there was a trial on behalf of one of Gotti's henchmen, and the evidence was that the neighbor was shot and then thrown into either water or acid or something. Could that have happened? Could either way you look at it, if this was a murder, then being nude could have been an act of final humiliation.
Yes, that's what I think, That's what I'm leaning toward.
Her staging a murder, it could have been, you know, we know that where the shirt was up around her neck on top of the ropes, it could have been saying, look what you'll be missing.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
That is why that 1250 phone call is so very important. And I think they need to get a PI in there to also look at what are the personalities here? Was there rage in any of these people? Was there low-level disharmony and that could have extended to this? Because you'd think that if he or somebody on his team called and said, oh, my God, the kid's not going to make it. We thought he was going to. He's not. He's dying. The first thing she would do, even if she wasn't allowed into the hospital room, is run down to the hospital and be in the parking lot and call him and say, I'm here for you.
Yes,
instead,
exactly.
She kills herself? Maybe, you know, who knows what was on that phone call, but that phone call did something.
It did. Dr. Weck, do you have some final thoughts?
No, I think I've said everything that, you know, I can think of at this time.
What do you think the next step is? What do you think the next step is here?
Well, the next step, I cannot speak for Ms. Bremner. I believe that an opportunity should be created for a visitation to the site. And here, the question, would Mr. Shackney permit this? It's his property. Nobody has a right to go on there. But if a court orders it, that can happen.
And maybe he wants to find out the answer. Maybe this is his girlfriend. Maybe he wants to.
Yeah, Donna. Well, that's right. if, and I don't know that a court would. It depends. But I mean, the question is what should be done, whether it will be permitted or can be accomplished. But I think a visitation to the scene, all kinds of measurements. Further tests to be done with the rope. Some of the wonderful observations Mr. Sinek made should be checked out, and so on. These are the things. And then I've already commented about the body. So I would hope that these things will be accomplished. I do not know if they are going to be undertaken, and I'm waiting to hear, frankly, from Ms. Bremner as to what she intends to do.
We have one more question, and Dr. Wecht, if you could just stay on the line with us, I want to ask Donna a question, because this might be tied into the whole thing, and that is the young boy, Maxie, who died accidentally, that kind of is what seems to have kicked all of this off, whatever it is.
Right.
What do you think happened, Donna? You said you had a theory. I would love to hear it. We can close the show with it.
Okay, well, we know that there were reports that the boy went down the stairs, fell down the stairs, but that's inconsistent with the wounds that his autopsy is also online. And also, they have theorized that he went over the stairs. And when he landed on the ground on the first floor, he had his Razor scooter laying against his leg. And there were reports from Rebecca's family that said Jonah was always yelling at the kid, don't use your Razor scooter on the balcony there. Stop doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So his soccer ball and his dog were also in the mix. So could he have tripped over that? Well, that's a big trip to fall over that balcony railing, which was, about as high as he was. But here's the other thing that everyone seems to ignore. There was a wonderful chandelier there that was on the ground next to him. So that kid, could he have been decided to swing on the chandelier and it came down and took him with it? Or did he go over the railing trying to reach it or, you know, reach for it and hoping it would hold his weight, and it didn't. And so I looked at a bunch of sites, and I saw the film Cheaper by the Dozen, which came out in, I think, 2003, Steve Martin film. And there's a scene of a kid about that age on roller skates in a mansion just like that place, and he's skating back and forth, and he decides to swing for the chandelier. And this is a movie. The chandelier holds, and the kid goes back and forth while his father, Steve Martin, tries to grab him. Well, movies aren't like real life.
Right.
And in this case, if that's what happened, you know, that explains why the chandelier was on the ground.
Yes, that's certainly what that's
and no
very
one
interesting.
It.
Mm-hmm. That, and you're absolutely right. And that's a very interesting and I think very logical way to explain things. Cynic, do you have any final thoughts?
Well, is that movie did they watch that movie recently? Did they have a copy of it? Was
very good
it, was
point.
It, something that was and, watched in the home.
And he saw
and,
that and
wanted
to try it.
More reason that that's an accident and not some devious, you know, you can't be everywhere with a kid, as you know.
Boy, do I know
feisty.
That. Oh, well, I could tell you stories. My heart just sinks every time I think about the scary, you know, almost moments when I lost track of my son. What could have happened to him? It happens to everybody. Cynic, do you have any final comments for us?
Yeah, I've got a few. First of all, I'd just like to thank Dr. Wagner again for not only obviously being on your show, but having the patience to answer my questions. I think there are definitely issues that must be addressed on both sides, regardless of your belief, whether it's suicide or murder. I still believe, as was echoed several times on the show, that the manner of death should have been listed as undetermined. I think it's also too bad that if this turns out not to be a suicide, that the police have worked very hard to give any future defense attorney pretty much half of their case. I think that also we should note that Rebecca's family, unlike the Shack and I, need help to have this case investigated properly, and it was mentioned before, but I guess those that are interested in helping, justiceforrebecca.org is the site to go to.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. We'll post that on Web Sleuths as well.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Donations.
Yes. Dr. Cyril Wecht, thank you so much. We just love and adore you.
Well,
and,
thank you. Thank you. Very gracious of you. My pleasure.
And we're going to do our best on Web Sleuths to try and get this case reopened and at least let the family figure out what happened. Donna Kaufman, tell us about your book. When is it due with you and Dr. Cyril Wecht? It's coming out in October, and it's called?
Yes, it's called From Crime Scene to Courtroom, and it's Dr. Wecht's cases, seven of his 54,000 cases, including Casey Anthony, Drew Peterson, Michael Jackson, Brian Jones, the founder of the Rolling Stones, who died in his swimming pool, will finally answer what happened there. And in three other cases that are all interesting, twisty cases. And you can order it online.
Thank you. And we'll put a link up to that as well on Web Sleuth so you can get your book coming out October 18th, did you say?
Yes.
From Courtroom to Crime Scene, correct?
Yes, Prometheus Books.
There you go. That's going to be fabulous. Thank you very much, and thank you for listening to Web Sleuths Radio. This will be available in the archives of the radio show if you'd like to listen to it again. Web Sleuths Radio is brought to you by a very wonderful organization called Dreamcatchers for AbusedChildren.com, a nonprofit organization where their mission is to educate the public on child abuse symptoms, interventions, and preventions. Visit them at dreamcatchersforabusedchildren.com. Now, the opinions expressed on this show are those of the guests and the host. That would be moi, and I take no responsibility for them, especially for my own opinions. Don't take responsibility for them. Anyway, Web Sleuths Radio is not the same thing as websleuths.com, which is a completely different corporate entity in itself, so you're going to have to deal with that. Hey, next week we're going to have a great show. I can't tell you what it is just yet, but I'm working on it. And trust me, you're going to love it. It's Web Sleuths Radio, true crime, current events, always discussed with common sense. Good night, everybody.